Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle, a Texas True Crime Podcast. This is episode 76, and I am Shay.
Hey, everyone, and I am Erin. We usually try to jump straight into the case at the top of an episode without a lot of chit-chat, but we do have a couple of things to briefly mention beforehand today because some very great things have happened since we last spoke to you all.
That's right.
First off, I can't believe that it was September or August and I'm saying this, but congratulations to the Dallas Stars hockey team who for the first time in two decades made it to the Stanley Cup Finals.
Woo-woo! Go Stars!
That's right. If you didn't know, we are huge Dallas Stars fans, and this has been so joyous and so gut-wrenching these last couple of weeks.
Yeah, we've been living on the edge of our seats.
Yeah. The Dallas Stars, unfortunately, did not win the cup, but they did fight hard, and we are so proud of the team, and it was one of the best distractions 2020 has to offer for sure.
Definitely. Go Stars!
Go Stars!
We'll get them next season.
Second, we have a very important update in a case we've covered on the show in episode 51, the Saeed sisters, the story of Sarah and Amina Saeed. This is probably one of the most distressing cases we've ever presented, and one that deeply affected anyone who knows what Sarah and Amina went through at the hands of their father. Well, I am delighted to report that Yasser Saeed, wanted for over 12 years in the murders of Sarah and Amina Saeed, is now in federal custody. In late August, he was arrested without incident in Justin, Texas. Two relatives have also been arrested and charged with harboring a fugitive. The story about how Yasser Saeed was finally located is fascinating, and for that reason, we're going to do a full update on this story in today's Good News segment, so be sure to stay tuned after the case.
Yes, it's very interesting. I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, it's great. It's really one of the best updates we've ever had on a case. And thank you to all the wonderful people who messaged us, emailed us. Whenever the news broke, we were quite overwhelmed with everything and obviously very happy, as were all of you. So we will talk more about that at the end of the episode today. Now, we've got a lot to talk about today. So without further ado, let's move on to today's case. At its heart, this story is about the inexplicable murder of a promising young man cut down in his prime by someone he trusted. But this confounding death happened to take place within the Baylor University basketball team, and it shed light on a scandal that ripped through the team and threatened the very university itself. Today's story is about sports, power, money, murder, and one man's quest to avoid losing it all. And this is a big story, so big, in fact, that we will be covering it in two parts. We're going to be talking a lot about basketball, in particular college basketball, but we will break everything down so even people like me, who knows pretty much nothing about college basketball, you'll still understand the basics.
I'm really excited for this case. I've been looking forward to hearing all about the details because I don't know a whole lot about it. I do know a little bit about the sports scandal involved from hearing it in the news, but I'd love to hear the actual case details.
Oh yeah, it is a dark, twisty web of lies and deceit and scandal in this case. So let's go ahead and get started with our sources. Many newspaper articles were used to cobble together this first part of the story, including the Albuquerque Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. More than those other sources, though, I used the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, with special consideration to reporters Jeff Kaplan, Bill Hanna, and Danny Robbins. Finally, there is a great Showtime documentary called Disgraced that was released in 2017 from director Pat Condellis. It's really well done and features interviews with a lot of the people we're going to be talking about today. We will discuss the documentary even further in part two next week. Patrick James Dennehy was born January 28, 1982. He was close to his mother and stepfather, Valerie and Brian, and his father, Patrick Sr. He also had a little sister a few years younger than him. Patrick grew up first in Santa Clara and then in Mountain View, California. Unlike a lot of future basketball stars, Patrick didn't start playing the game until middle school, when coaches spotted his frame at already well over 6 feet tall. He'd grow to be 6'10" and 230 pounds. He had the body of a pro basketball player, and he was good too. He showed great talent on the basketball court in high school and started being wooed by university teams. His ultimate dream was to play professional basketball for the Sacramento Kings, his home team.
Wow, 6'10", that's pretty big. Sounds like he's on his way to being the perfect size for a professional basketball player anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Patrick ended up going to the University of New Mexico, joining their basketball team, the UNM Lobos, as a power forward in the year 2000. His talents were apparent at the college level, and Patrick became the third leading freshman rebounder in the history of the school.
Wow.
His sophomore year, he averaged 10.6 points and 7.5 rebounds. Now, I don't really know anything about basketball, but from context clues, I'm told that those are pretty good stats.
Yeah, it seems pretty good.
Yeah. But you know, Patrick wasn't just a really good basketball player. He liked working out, lifting weights, playing video games, listening to music, and writing poetry. He was generally a quiet, soft-spoken, and nice young man. He began dating Jessica, another UNM student athlete on the track team. Everything seemed to be going really well. But in February of 2002, after Patrick had been at UNM for two seasons, something strange happened. The normally reserved Patrick had an outburst during a game against the Air Force, where he began arguing with teammates, shoved one of them, and kicked over a chair before storming to the locker room 3 minutes before the end of the game. The Lobos ended up losing, and afterwards, Patrick received a lot of criticism from sports media and fans, a lot of people calling him a loose cannon, that he's a bad seed, all of this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, remember, this is a 20-year-old kid who lost his temper, and it just happened to occur in front of a lot of people.
Yeah, and he wasn't the first, and he's definitely not going to be the last to do something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the blowback he got was a lot for a 20-year-old, I think, to handle. You know, that's a lot of stress. Now, the team's head coach never disciplined Patrick for this outburst that he had, and he even publicly seemed to support him, but the head coach was replaced soon after, and Patrick ended up getting dismissed from the team. But Patrick was smart, he was talented, and he was quickly picked back up. Just 1 month later, it was announced that Patrick Dennehy had accepted a scholarship to Baylor University, where he would join the Baylor Bears basketball team and major in speech communications.
Oh, wow. So that seemed to sort of work out into his favor, because Baylor's a pretty big program.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this probably was a pretty good setup for Patrick. So let's talk a little bit about Waco and Baylor University. Founded in 1845, Baylor University is the oldest university in Texas, and with about 14,000 students, it is the largest Baptist university in the world. Baylor is located in Waco, Texas, situated about midway between Dallas and Austin, and with a population of about 120,000 people.
Yeah, it's really hard to miss when you go down 35 on your way to Austin, or if you're coming the other direction to DFW, you drive right through the middle of campus on 35.
Yeah, you drive right by the stadium, I believe,
right? Yeah, the football stadium, yeah.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, Baylor University's mascot is the American Black Bear, and its teams, the Baylor Bears or the Baylor Lady Bears. The university has a century-long tradition of even keeping live bears as mascots.
Today,
really? Yeah, that's right. Today, it has two, Joy and Lady.
Man, I hope they're well kept for.
I said the same thing. I don't know. I'm assuming they are, and I'm going to just leave it at that.
Yeah. I mean, it all, as an animal lover, it always bothers me when teams use real animals
I know.
As their mascot.
Agreed. But let's hope that, you know, they're doing well.
Yeah.
Taken care of, get lots of meat, honey. I don't know. Whatever bears want. When Patrick Dennehy joined the Baylor basketball team in 2002, things hadn't been going super great for the program. They hadn't really been successful in years, so in 1999, the program let go of the head coach and hired the very esteemed Dave Bliss as the new head coach of the men's basketball team. Bliss had an untarnished 30-year career as a head coach at places like Oklahoma, SMU, and New Mexico. But even with Bliss at the helm, the Baylor men's basketball team still struggled to even finish above 500. In fact, in four seasons during which Dave Bliss was the head coach, the team's total record was 61-57.
Oh, wow. So kind of middle of the road.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very average record. It's not terrible, but it's definitely not great either.
And it's also a bad record if you're in that conference, their conference being the Big 12. I'm sure there's a lot of other powerhouse basketball teams in their conference, so.
Yeah, and for a university that prides itself on its athletic programs and makes a lot of money off of its athletic programs, that is not ideal, having this, like, pretty basic average record.
Yeah, college sports is supposed to be a big moneymaker for private universities.
So. Oh, it absolutely is. And during this time, Baylor also had not earned a spot in the big NCAA tournament in years. And that is a lot of TV money that isn't going to Baylor. There are millions, even billions of dollars at stake just in TV contracts and deals for college-level sports alone. And the better your team is doing, the more money you're making for your school. Because honestly, it all comes back down to money. You want your teams to do well so you can sell tickets, merch, drum up support, get fans involved, get on TV, and all of that directly relates to financial earnings for an athletic program.
Oh, and not to mention to attract donors, because a lot of times the donors to your university are attracted by how well your sports teams are doing.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of pressure on the coaching staff of college athletics programs to do well. But ultimately, the plan with Dave Bliss at the helm was to restructure the team, pick up new additions, people like Patrick Dennehy, and really get things going. So that's kind of what they were on track for doing about the time that Patrick was joining the team.
So Patrick was kind of looked at this point as sort of a diamond in the rough player who had a lot of potential, something that it was like a good find for Dave Bliss for him to improve their middle of the road basketball team.
Yeah, absolutely. Patrick and a few of the other teammates that we're going to be talking about as well. So Patrick seemed to fit into his new life at Baylor really well. It seemed like it was a perfect fit for him. He told the Albuquerque Journal, quote, "Playing in the Big 12 will be a great opportunity for me to improve my game and get into the NBA. He continued, "It's a fresh start. I feel great. It's a new coach, a new team, a new set of personalities. Coach Bliss is a great guy. Things worked out for the best." Now, because Patrick was a student athlete transferring from one Division I program to another, according to NCAA regulations, Patrick was ineligible to officially play on the team for the first year. It's what they call a red shirt. We're going to be talking more about the NCAA and what it does, and even some criticism of the organization next week. But basically, the National Collegiate Athletic Association is the organization that governs college sports programs around the country. They make the rules that are supposed to support student athletes and university programs and ensure everything is fair. So this year of ineligibility meant that Patrick had a full year to really settle in Waco. He could focus on school and keep up with practice before he'd actually begin to play on the team for real. In the interim, through 2002 and into the spring of 2003, Patrick moved down to Waco into an apartment right by the Baylor basketball stadium at the Sterling University Apartments. He got a vehicle, a used black 1996 Chevy Tahoe. Patrick's girlfriend, Jessica, stayed behind at UNM, but the two continued their long-distance relationship and even began seriously talking about marriage. Patrick regularly attended class and made good grades. And although he was kind of a loner, Patrick made friends with his new teammates, some of whom even lived with him at one point or another. One teammate in particular became very close to Patrick, Carlton Dotson. Carlton was raised mostly by his grandmother in Hurlock, Maryland. He was a star on his high school basketball team at North Dorchester High School, leading the team to a state championship in 1999. And he was kind of a hometown hero.
Sure. Anyone who leads a team to a state championship, I'm sure, gets kind of, you know, free run of the town and whatever they want.
And as far as I understand, this was a pretty small school in a pretty small town. So he was, you know, everybody loved him. Mm-hmm. Carlton had recently transferred to Baylor from Paris Junior College around the same time as Patrick, although Carlton was allowed to play on the team immediately since he had transferred from a junior college instead of a four-year school.
Oh, is that how that works?
Mm-hmm. So Carlton, described as really friendly and gregarious, hit it off with Patrick right away, and the two became close friends. But while things for Patrick seemed to be getting better and better, Carlton's personal life was quietly falling apart. In August of 2002, Carlton married his girlfriend of 2 years, Melissa, a student athlete on the softball team at Paris Junior College. The two had moved together to Waco so Carlton could attend Baylor. But by April of 2003, the eight-month marriage had already fallen apart, and Melissa had moved back home to Sulphur Springs, Texas. As far as life on the basketball court was concerned, the 2002-2003 season started off well for Carlton. But as the weeks and months dragged on, he began seeing less and less playtime. Eventually, Coach Dave Bliss and Carlton came to the conclusion that Carlton and Baylor weren't a good fit. Carlton lost his scholarship to Baylor and would have to try to transfer to another school for playtime.
Oh, man. He is going through a lot.
Absolutely. So by the spring of 2003, Carlton had split from his wife. He no longer had a scholarship or anywhere to play basketball. He was living with Patrick because he had nowhere else to go. Patrick was kind enough to let Carlton stay with him for a while until he kind of figured things out.
Well, that was really nice of him.
True. Now, what exactly happened in the lead up to June 2003, we may never know. But the following is a brief reconstruction of events that would eventually lead to murder. Late in May, another player named Harvey Thomas arrived in Waco. He had transferred to Baylor from Northeast Oklahoma A&M, a junior college, although he had bounced around several different programs before that. Harvey met Carlton and Patrick soon after his arrival, and the three became friends, with Harvey even moving into the apartment with Patrick and Carlton for a while. But this friendship between Patrick, Carlton, and Harvey was fleeting and soured quickly. According to friends and family members, at the beginning of June, Patrick and Carlton began mentioning that a teammate named Harvey had threatened them, and that it was a threat they took seriously.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and this is the strange thing, is because the exact nature of these alleged threats is unknown to this day. But one friend of the group named Daniel told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that he believed Harvey's threats had been targeted at Carlton, and that Patrick just had Carlton's back.
And it's also interesting that both Patrick and Carlton mentioned these threats together. So there's more than just one person. So it seems like there's some legitimacy to these threats.
It definitely seems that way. From the number of people who either talked to the press or talked to law enforcement about all of these things that they heard about this other Baylor teammate threatening Patrick and Carlton, there were several people who either said it was a teammate just in general, or they specified that it was Harvey Thomas. Around this same time, Patrick also told friends and family that his apartment had been broken into several times and small items like cologne and money had gone missing. It seemed as if Carlton and Patrick believed that Harvey was behind these thefts.
So Harvey had at one point lived in that apartment with them, but has no longer living there. And now they think he's breaking back in because he knows the place, he knows what they have, and he must be behind this because he's threatening them.
Yeah, at this point, that's what it seems like they believed. Now, whether or not any of these things are true, we don't know. But at this time, it seemed like Patrick and Carlton believed that they were in danger.
Interesting.
In fact, the two became so concerned about these alleged threats that they decided to take matters into their own hands to protect themselves. On June 2nd, Patrick purchased a .22 caliber rifle and a 9mm or a 32mm semi-automatic pistol. I don't know, I saw different sources list that separately, so I'm not sure exactly, but it was just basically a handgun, and then he also bought a .22 caliber rifle. Carlton also purchased himself a 9mm semi-automatic pistol.
Okay. So these guys are now armed to the teeth.
Yeah, pretty much. So they purchased the weapons on June 2nd, and they picked them up on June 7th after that mandatory 5-day waiting period. So, yeah, pretty much right after this, they became very attached to these weapons.
And it also shows that they really feel threatened.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. According to another Baylor student who was also staying at Patrick's apartment around the same time, Patrick and Carlton became increasingly paranoid. They changed the locks on the apartment door. They always kept the deadbolt locked when they were there. They cautioned him to not let anyone else enter the apartment. And they even started answering the door with their guns drawn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it should be noted that, according to both Patrick and Carlton's friends and family, this was completely out of character for them. Neither one of them had really shown an interest in guns or shooting ever before. So it really seemed like this was something born out of necessity or fear rather than interest in a new hobby.
Yeah, it makes me kind of wonder what else Harvey had either said or done that they hadn't reported or spoken to anyone about to make them so scared and paranoid about this Harvey guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And on top of everything else, neither one of them sought a license to carry in Texas, and guns were not allowed on campus where Patrick and Carlton lived. So there are a lot of issues going on right now. Patrick and Carlton didn't just buy guns to protect themselves, though. The two actively began practicing using them, too. They headed off a few times into rural deserted areas around Waco and practiced shooting. One place they visited a couple times together to shoot was a 50-acre property 20 miles northeast of Waco in Mount Calm. This ranch was owned by Darren and Tammy Cox, who had met Patrick and Carlton earlier in the year when the two college athletes had answered the Cox's ad looking for homes for pit bull puppies.
Hmm.
Darren and Tammy had taken the young men under their wing, and Patrick and Carlton would often visit the ranch to hang out, fish, play basketball with their kids. It was like a little family home life the two got to enjoy while they were away at college. It sounds very sweet and wholesome, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, Darren and Tammy told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that on June 10th, Patrick and Carlton came to visit and to shoot their new guns at the property. According to the Coxes, the two young men said that another player on the team had threatened them with a gun the night before and that they were scared for their lives. The Coxes did not learn the name of the player, but Darren told them that they needed to tell coaches and law enforcement what was going on, and the two promised that they would.
Okay, but that seems like that didn't happen.
That's actually one of the biggest points of contention or questions involved in this case is, was this going on? And if it was going on, who knew what was going on? Was there anybody, were there any coaching staff that were supervising the situation that were aware of these threats or that their student athletes were feeling targeted, feeling in danger? We don't know.
Very well, true crime wizard. Keep your secrets for next episode.
That's right. But then on June 11th, this is the day after Patrick and Carlton visited the Coxes, Patrick's Tahoe was broken into. And it seems as though the vehicle break-in really alarmed Patrick and Carlton even further, like whoever was threatening them was further upping the ante.
Jeez, I want to know, like, what happened to, like, draw this kind of attention to them from someone.
You know what? I wish I knew that, too. Now, Patrick spoke on the phone to his girlfriend, Jessica, that evening, and she told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that he told her that Harvey Thomas had threatened him and Carlton repeatedly. You know, she went over the whole thing about how he was scared. And although their conversation was short, she said that it was otherwise pretty normal. Now, the next day, Patrick attended his afternoon classes as usual, but he did not attend classes on June 13th, a Friday. June 15th was Father's Day, and Brian, Patrick's stepfather, who was living in Carson City, Nevada, was surprised to not get a phone call. Brian recalled this as being strange, but he knew that Patrick was busy with school, and he was getting ready to actually start playing for Baylor, you know, for the team, so he didn't really think too much about it. But the next day, Patrick Dennehy once again did not attend class. Chris, the roommate living at Patrick's apartment at the time, came home from a trip to find that Patrick's dogs hadn't been fed in days, and neither Patrick nor Carlton were anywhere to be found.
Weird.
Mm-hmm.
Especially considering it sounds like he really cares about these dogs.
Yeah, like apparently Patrick and Carlton really love dogs and they love these pit bulls. So the fact that they weren't fed, weren't cared for days was very alarming to people. Now, at this point, Patrick's absences from class finally came to the attention of the Baylor basketball coaching staff. But it wasn't until the following day, June 17th, that officials decided to contact Patrick's parents. They called Valerie, Patrick's mother. But apparently, get this, they didn't have her correct phone number. So 2 more days went by with no sign of Patrick, and it wasn't until the 19th that the coaching staff finally got a hold of Brian to tell him that Patrick had not been to class for a week.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Immediately realizing that something was wrong, Brian contacted the Waco Police Department and made a missing persons report on his stepson, Patrick Dennehy. Waco police searched Patrick's apartment, but reportedly didn't find anything suspicious, although it was noted that Patrick's 1996 Chevy Tahoe was also missing.
Man, that is just so shocking that it took that long for the authorities to be involved and for the school to contact the parents to let them know, hey, your kid hasn't been on campus for a week and nobody's seen him. There's also been reports that his dogs haven't been fed, his car's missing. Like, this is bad.
I really want to know, how hard did they try to contact Patrick's parents? I mean, it looked like they had a phone number. It wasn't the correct phone number. Maybe it was an old number or a typo. Who knows? But I mean, did they then try to track down other ways to contact Patrick's parents? That's one question that I have that I don't know the answer to. But yes, very problematic that it took so long for anybody to really report that Patrick was missing to his parents.
Yeah, and no pun intended, but it really does seem like the campus and the administration really did drop the ball really early on in this case.
I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you on that. Yeah. Now, at this point, Patrick hadn't been seen or heard from in days, and investigators began speaking to his friends and family members to try to get additional information about where he could be. And, as you might imagine, a lot of people mentioned one name in particular, Harvey Thomas. So Harvey spoke to investigators, cooperated fully, and even eventually offered to take a polygraph test, saying that he had never threatened his teammates, he had no idea what they were talking about, and he did not know where Patrick was.
Interesting.
Investigators even got a search warrant for Patrick's computer to try to find traces of any emailed threats or suspicious activity, but nothing conclusive ever surfaced. The Waco Police Department released a statement basically saying, yeah, this isn't our guy.
Huh. Did he take the polygraph test?
I believe he did. I believe he volunteered for one. I believe he took it, but I don't know if the results were ever released or anything.
Well, and it's one of those things where if there were no results to be found, then they probably didn't release any information about it.
You mean if it was inconclusive or if it showed that he was not lying, that he was telling the truth? I agree with that, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, tons of people take lie detector tests and we never hear about people who pass with flying colors, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible. And we have the Waco Police Department here saying Harvey Thomas didn't have anything to do with Patrick Dennehy's disappearance. Yeah.
So what the heck happened?
Well, that's what they're trying to find out. So their next move is, of course, to talk to Patrick's best friend, Carlton Dodson. But when they go to talk to him, they find out that he's left town. Nobody really knows where he is.
Uh-oh.
So investigators instead contacted Melissa, Carlton's estranged wife. She told them that she had last seen Carlton on June 12th, the evening of the last day Patrick had been seen alive. She said that on that day, Carlton had visited her in her home in Sulphur Springs and told her that he was on his way back home to Maryland. What's more, though, is that Melissa said that Carlton had been driving Patrick Dennehy's Chevy Tahoe, the vehicle that had gone missing at the same time as Patrick.
Wow. That is not a good look.
It is not.
And also, for those of you who aren't familiar with Texas geography, Sulphur Springs is not close to Waco. It's on your way from DFW all the way up to Paris, which is close to the direction of the border of Oklahoma. So it could have been that he was on his way back to Maryland, but just going to see his girlfriend. But that is so weird that he would take Patrick's car and just head off and drive to Sulphur Springs. It's not a good look. It looks like he's on the run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let me remind you that this happened the last day that Patrick had been seen alive on campus.
Right.
But then there's a little break in the case. On June 25th, that missing vehicle was finally located. It was found abandoned in a parking lot of a strip mall in Virginia Beach, Virginia, with the license plates removed. When police ran the VIN number, it came back as a match to Patrick Dennehy and the missing persons case out of Texas. Patrick didn't have any known contacts in the Virginia Beach area, and no one knew why his vehicle would be there. And of course, even scarier is the fact that it was abandoned with no license plates.
Right.
Why would Patrick do that?
It does look suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Law enforcement continued sweeps of the local areas around the university to try to find Patrick Dennehy himself or some other evidence of his whereabouts. Searches would eventually include Darren and Tammy's property up in Mount Calm, even including thermal imaging by helicopter and a ground search with ATVs. But unfortunately, as June turned into July, there was still no sign of Patrick Dennehy. But just a few days after Patrick was officially listed as a missing person in Waco, an informant contacted the Seaford Police Department to report that his cousin, Carlton Dodson, had admitted to killing Patrick Dennehy while they were out shooting guns together. Afterward, the informant said that Carlton told him that he'd driven back to his hometown of Hurlock, Maryland, disposing of his and Patrick's guns along the way. And as a side note, Virginia Beach, where Patrick's Tahoe was abandoned, was only 150 miles away from Hurlock. So if the story is true, Carlton would have had to have abandoned the Tahoe and then found some other kind of transportation back to Maryland.
Wow, so it's really surprising to see that someone who we thought was, you know, one of his really good friends, who was allegedly being threatened by someone right alongside of Patrick, and they were kind of in this whole thing together, and they were bonding together as brothers, now seems like he might be the perpetrator, and that is just wild.
It was shocking. It was shocking to everybody, and this was reported in the media. And so everybody was just so confused. Why are people saying that Carlton Dodson killed Patrick? That's impossible. They're best friends.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. But with nothing else really to go on, there's no hard evidence besides this informant's story that they said Carlton Dotson told them. There really isn't a sure sign of a crime because Patrick is still missing. We don't have a body. We don't have really even a for sure sign that something bad has happened here, right?
Sure.
Then on July 17th, Carlton Dotson contacted the Dorchester County authorities in Maryland and requested to speak with someone. He was interviewed by two detectives and an FBI agent, but was not charged with anything and was free to go. A little weird, huh?
What?
But only days later, on the 20th, Carlton called the police from a grocery store in Chestertown, Maryland, about 55 miles away from Hurlock. He claimed that he was hearing voices and that he needed help. Carlton was picked up and taken to the Chester River Hospital Center for a mental evaluation and stayed overnight, after which he was again interviewed by FBI agents. This time, according to officials, he, quote, made strong incriminating statements against his interests. At the end of July, the criminal complaint against Carlton Dotson was released that detailed what Carlton told officers during this time, and it essentially was a detailed confession.
Wow. That is so weird that they let him go the first time, and there had to be a second time that they went and questioned him, though. Because it is weird that the last time he was seen, he was driving Patrick's car, and then Patrick's car seems to be abandoned somewhere in the area where he was headed.
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly what was being said during that first initial conversation. We don't know what Carlton told them, but we do know what Carlton told them the second time around that we're going to go over right now.
Oh, interesting.
So Carlton told investigators that either on July 11th or 12th, he and Patrick decided to drive to an old gravel pit outside of town to go shooting. They'd been to the spot once or twice before. Patrick parked the Tahoe and they walked a short distance to a clearing. Suddenly, Carlton said Patrick raised his gun, pointed it at Carlton, and pulled the trigger, but the gun jammed. Carlton pointed his own gun at Patrick and said aloud, quote, "Father, please forgive me," and shot Patrick in the head either once or twice. He said he wasn't quite sure how many times.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. After the shooting, Carlton said he threw Patrick's gun down the road and drove away in Patrick's Tahoe. He called his grandmother in Maryland and asked her to send him money. He drove to Patrick's apartment where he changed his clothes and packed his belongings. Then he drove the Tahoe to Sulphur Springs where he visited his estranged wife, Melissa. He said he dumped the gun in a lake somewhere on his way to Maryland.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's so hard to like parse anything out of this story because he's clearly not in the right mental state if he's hearing voices and going to a mental facility. So did that happen? Is this some weird twisted version of the events in his own head? I mean,
oh, believe me, you are on track with all the right questions so far.
Goodness. But it is fascinating though.
Yeah. Carlton was obviously arrested on June 21st after these incriminating statements, and he was held without bail as extradition procedures began. From Kent County Jail in Maryland, he began speaking out to reporters fairly frequently. First off, right after being arrested and making this confession that we just went over, Carlton told a reporter, quote, "I didn't confess to anything. Call the FBI." So he denied making these statements, basically, to the reporter, and then he asked them to talk to the FBI, who he had been talking. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So he denied making these statements, basically making a confession, and then he asked them to contact the FBI, who he himself had been in frequent contact with. In fact, some of the people he probably made these statements to were FBI agents.
Right.
Then, just over a week after his arrest, the Dallas Morning News quoted Carlton as saying, quote, "I thought he was my friend, but he betrayed me. If someone points a gun at you and shoots and it doesn't go off, what would you do? If someone is pointing a gun at you and they start putting more bullets into the gun, what would you do?"
I mean, that is a great point, if that happened.
Exactly. So all of this was baffling to people. Was Patrick alive or had Carlton killed him? Is Carlton admitting to killing Patrick in self-defense or not? Is he just messing with the media trying to get attention?
So I'm curious to hear more about that tip that got called in saying that Carlton had confessed about killing Patrick. I want to hear what that version sounds like before he had more time to think about it or before his mental state decayed a little bit more. Did he tell them the same events happened that way?
From what I understand, yes, the stories were pretty much the same.
Okay, so far his story hasn't changed.
Not really. Yeah, it's the story of they went shooting, Patrick went to shoot him, and Carlton killed him instead.
Did he have a reason why Patrick would shoot him?
Well, I mean, he does mention something about an argument or something. I mean, there's kind of these threads, like maybe there was something going on, they got into an argument, but it's not sure. I mean, basically all he says was, we were just going to go out shooting. I turned and looked at Patrick and he was pulling a gun out on me and was going to shoot me.
Wow.
I mean, it's nonsensical, but this is what Carlton is saying.
Hmm.
But Carlton wasn't just exhibiting this strange behavior only in the immediate aftermath of Patrick's disappearance. As I mentioned earlier, we know that just before Carlton was arrested, he reportedly stated he'd been hearing voices and he went into a mental evaluation, just like you brought up, Shay. Well, Carlton also told investigators that he believed people were out to kill him. He talked about the threats that he and Patrick said they received. He said that he was Jesus, the Son of God, and that's why people were trying to kill him. But that wasn't all. Many of Carlton's family and friends, even his reverend back home, spoke at length to the press and to law enforcement about Carlton's activities and behavior in the recent weeks since he'd returned to Maryland. They said that, although Carlton had never been known to be especially religious, he was all at once incredibly devout. He told people that he was seeing demons and angels, that he had special powers, and that people were following him. According to the Washington Post, one relative that Carlton stayed with said that one night he stayed up all night reading aloud from the Bible and pacing her living room floor. At some point during the night, she'd awoken to hear Carlton making strange noises and heard banging sounds in the living room. The next morning, Carlton told her that he had wrestled a demon in her living room the night before and even showed her bloody scratches on his arm as if to prove it.
Yikes. Man, yeah. He sounds like he is in some real mental decline.
Yeah, and he had been acting so strangely, in fact, that when he first told his cousin, the informant, about shooting Patrick, his cousin hadn't believed him. It wasn't until he'd heard that Patrick Dennehy was missing in Texas that the story clicked. And it's because, you know, according to him, Carlton was saying all of these strange things. He was acting so bizarre that if he turns around and looks at you and say, I shot somebody, you're not going to believe him, right? Because...
yeah, because he just wrestled a demon in your living room. It also makes you really wonder, again, does any of his story about what went down with that fatal moment between him and Patrick, is any of that even real? Or did he just see it and has told himself that that's what happened so much that he believes it?
Carlton's bizarre behavior, though, had been even more long-term than that, according to his estranged wife, Melissa. She said that Carlton had first been acting unstable around the time they'd first moved to Waco together in November of 2002, a little less than a year before. She said that he had started referring to himself as a prophet from God and told her that she was possessed by an evil spirit. He told her about having visions and hearing voices. According to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Melissa said Carlton's behavior was so concerning that her mother ended up writing a letter to the Baylor coaching staff telling them that she was afraid that Carlton was mentally unwell. Unfortunately, the letter was written in early June and wasn't received until June 12th, the last day that Patrick was seen alive.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
That's really unfortunate. Jeez.
It's very sad. In an interview with the Associated Press, Melissa said, quote, I've known that he's needed psychological help for a very long time.
Well, no wonder their marriage fell apart so fast. Did Patrick know about this too? I mean, he had to have, right? They were living together.
You know, what Patrick thought or what he knew or didn't know is up to debate, you know?
Man.
It's hard to say. Now, we don't know this for sure, but it seems like Carlton's statements to law enforcement pretty quickly led to the tragic discovery of Patrick Dennehy's body on July 25th, 2003, about 6 weeks after he was last seen alive. He was just 21 years old.
Man, he was right about to play basketball too, right?
He was.
I mean, he never really got to play for Baylor.
Yeah, he was going to be starting, I believe. Yes, I believe that fall he would be officially eligible to start playing basketball for Baylor.
Oh, yeah. How tragic.
I know. His body, severely decomposed, was found just a few miles southeast of the Baylor campus in an area with lots of gravel pits and heavy scrub brush. He was taken to the Dallas County Medical Examiner's Office for autopsy, which would later call into question some of the statements that Carlton made to law enforcement. We will talk more about that next episode. Patrick's family and friends, and indeed the entire Baylor community, mourned his loss. But Patrick's death was made even more unbearable given that another Baylor basketball player, his best friend, was now being charged with his murder. Patrick's girlfriend, Jessica, told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, "I don't get it. I don't know what in the world happened to Carlton in his mind that he could do something like this. It does not add up. Patrick has never been anything but a caring friend to Carlton." Now, this story drew national media attention. Consider all the elements here. A Baylor basketball player was killed, and another Baylor basketball player was charged with his murder. That's already a huge story. It's never happened before.
Sure.
And it's not just your normal sources and journalists talking about this disappearance that has turned into a murder investigation. It's all over sports news and sports media coverage, too. So everyone is talking about this, and everybody is looking at Baylor and wondering, how could something so tragic, so terrible, happen there?
Yeah, and, you know, if they hadn't have played basketball at Baylor, would this even be a national story? Like, it's just because they played sports that we probably even know a lot of the details in this case.
I think there's probably a lot of truth to that statement, yeah. And as answers began to be uncovered in Patrick's disappearance, other questions began to pile up. Just how much supervision did the Baylor coaching staff of the men's basketball team provide their players? Were they aware that Carlton was exhibiting strange behavior, and had they tried to help him? Did they know about the threats that Carlton and Patrick said they received from another player on the team? And once the ball started rolling and people started digging in and asking questions, a web of lies, drugs, cheating, and other bold NCAA violations under head coach Dave Bliss was uncovered. Next episode, we will talk about justice for Patrick Dennehy and how exactly the investigation into his disappearance would uncover rules and ethics violations that would threaten the reputation of the entire Baylor athletic department. And they say that all publicity is good publicity. Well, this may be one of the exceptions to the rule.
Man, I cannot wait to hear about all those things you just mentioned. I want to learn more about the program and what they knew. I want to know more about like what the friends knew, other basketball players. Man.
Well, I can't promise we're going to get all of those answers, but we're going to talk about as much as we can. So it's going to be a really packed part two. We have a lot still to talk about. There's so much more to this story.
Very exciting. I'm just going to have to wait like everybody else. And as always, for two-parters, that part sucks.
It really does. I'm so sorry.
So besides moving on to part two and that coming out next week, I am very excited to get to the capture of Yasser Saeed. So please give us some good news, Aaron.
I'm on it. Let's do that up next.
All right. We'll be right back after this. I'm not sure what everybody else does when they finish a podcast or a new book that they're reading and has to pick out something new to do. But sometimes when I don't want to jump back into researching a new case, I just pull up Best Fiends and start playing some games, solving some puzzles.
That's right. I love Best Fiends because it's a great way to de-stress between recording for the show, and it gives you a nice rush of adrenaline whenever you beat a level.
Oh yeah, it does. How many levels have you cleared so far, Aaron?
Well, Shay, I will happily brag that I'm at level 1,210.
Wow, that's impressive.
Best Fiends is the infamously impossible to put down puzzle game with over 100 million downloads and counting. There are more levels, events, and challenges that get added all the time, so you can always play. There's always one more level to get through. And when you have over 5,000 of them, it means that you have a good challenge on your hands.
Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends.
On New Year's Day, 2008, sisters 18-year-old Amina and 17-year-old Sarah were found shot to death in the backseat of their father's taxicab in Irving, Texas. The girl's father, Yasser Saeed, the number one suspect in the double homicide of his two teenage daughters, had never been seen from again. The day after Amina and Sarah's deaths, a capital murder warrant was issued for Yasser Saeed's arrest. In 2014, he was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And still, Yasser Saeed continued to avoid detection. But then, on Wednesday, August 26, 2020, the FBI's Dallas Violent Crimes Task Force announced that it had made an arrest in the case. That's right, folks. Yasser Saeed is now in custody.
Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Oof. What a relief.
Well, this is what we know so far based on the criminal complaint that has been released. Over the years, countless hypotheses erupted regarding Yasser Saeed's whereabouts, with many wondering if other members of Saeed's family were helping conceal him, either right here in Texas or abroad. Remember, Saeed's family was from Egypt and he had a lot of contacts there.
Right. And a lot of people thought he had just fled the country.
Absolutely. Now, we don't know what Yasser Saeed was up to between the years of 2008 and 2017. Law enforcement is still trying to reconstruct this. But what we do know is that in 2017, Yasser Saeed was spotted and reported to officials, and he had been right here in the DFW area. You see, Yasser Saeed's son, Islam, was living at the Copper Canyon Apartments in Bedford, Texas, when on August 14th, 2017, a maintenance worker visited his apartment to make some repairs. The worker tried to let himself into the apartment when his knocks went unanswered, but the door was deadlocked from the inside. So there's clearly somebody there, right?
Right.
So he continued to knock on the door, and finally an older man who was not Islam appeared at the door. The man allowed the maintenance worker in to do whatever repairs he needed, and the worker left, and then went straight to the apartment manager and reported that the man he'd seen in the apartment was the man from the FBI's wanted poster, Yasser Saeed.
That is so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did he know? Like, obviously he's been up on true crime and the case and had looked at the FBI's most wanted list. I think I've looked at it like twice. And
Well, this is what I think. I think it's certainly possible that law enforcement, the FBI, whoever, has never lost sight of Islam, and for all of these years, they've been checking up on him in case he was harboring his father. And I believe they went to Islam's apartment management team and made them aware of the situation, gave them the FBI wanted posters and said, keep an eye out for this guy.
Wow. So maybe it was just sitting like in the maintenance shed on the door, you know, like tacked up on the door or something.
Yeah, maybe.
And he was like, oh, I found him.
Maybe, but yeah, either way, this guy saw him, knew who he was, and they basically immediately reported the sighting to the FBI.
That is so amazing.
It's great. So the next day, the FBI Dallas SWAT team paid Islam a little visit. They requested permission to search his apartment. He, of course, refused. And according to phone records, he then called one of his uncles and told them, quote, we have a problem. In the early hours of the next morning, FBI agents executed a search warrant on the apartment. They busted in the door, took a look around. There was no one inside of the apartment, but the back patio door was open and the bushes underneath the patio were all beat to hell as if somebody had jumped off the patio, jumped into the bush and fled.
Wow.
As soon as the SWAT team showed up, right? They also collected a pair of eyeglasses that were found laying next to the bush. In Islam's apartment, FBI agents collected several items, including used cigarette butts and a toothbrush, from which DNA was collected. With a 1 in 5.3 quintillion probability, the DNA found on the eyeglasses collected underneath the patio of the apartment and the DNA from the toothbrush and cigarette butts matched that of the biological father of Amina and Sarah Saeed.
That's what we call an exact match.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is what I find very poetic and beautiful, is they actually used Amina and Sarah's DNA to positively ID Yasser Saeed's DNA on these items. Then, late on the evening of August 26, 2017, Islam was just at the Canadian border. This was only 12 days after the FBI search of his apartment in Bedford, Texas, and then he's suddenly at the border trying to leave the country.
Man, he must have had a bug out bag or something ready to go.
Probably. So he wasn't driving the car, he was the passenger. The driver told the Border Patrol agents that he and Islam were just taking a, quote, crazy road trip. Not that Islam was trying to flee the country or anything, you know.
Yeah.
So that's all we know about what happened back in 2017. Yasir Saeed was positively identified here in North Texas, but he was already in the wind again. So now let's move forward to the events of August 2020, just last month. On August 17th, the FBI began 24-hour surveillance at the home of the daughter of Yasin Saeed, one of Yasir Saeed's brothers. So this is Yasir Saeed's niece's house in Justin, Texas, about 30 miles north of Bedford, where Yasir Saeed had last been spotted by the maintenance worker. As the FBI watched the house, it became more and more apparent that there was someone else living at the home who was never seen outside of it. For example, FBI agents would see Islam and Yasin drive up to the house, deliver groceries, carry out bags of trash that then they'd put in their car and drive away. Very strange. One night, agents even spotted a person moving within the house after Islam and Yasin had just left when the house supposedly sat empty. So that's all pretty strange, right?
Very strange.
So on August 25th, after one of these trips where Islam and Yasin would drop stuff off at the house and come back out with bags of trash, FBI agents followed the two all the way to Southlake, about 19 miles away, and they threw those bags of trash into a dumpster at a shopping center. Agents grabbed the trash, where they found cigarette butts and garbage. I'm assuming they probably collected those for DNA evidence as well.
Yeah.
The next day, they got a search warrant for the house, where Yasir Saeed was finally arrested without incident on August 26th, 12 years after Amina and Sarah's deaths.
Man, what a wild capture story.
It is. And it's interesting about this house. I think the FBI and the Irving Police Department and all of these other law enforcement agencies have just been on the ball. They've just never forgotten about this case. They've been watching family, friends, because mm-hmm. they knew he's being harbored somewhere. So, I mean, it is interesting that he was found right here in North Texas.
Yeah, and how many times have we driven through HEB, headed up to somewhere in North DFW, and we've driven right by? Like, he was right there.
Yeah, so I mean, close. It's pretty incredible, because honestly, I thought he was in Egypt. I mean, why wouldn't you go back to Egypt after you've committed murder?
Sure, or this last time when he drove to the Canadian border, maybe he did find a way to get across and he was gone to Canada.
Yeah, you know? And that's something that a lot of people believed as well.
And it's so interesting too, because I think off the podcast, privately, when I asked you, well, where do you think he is? You said to me, you thought there was a huge chance that his son had something to do with hiding him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that wasn't just me. A lot of people believed either his son or his brothers were helping harbor him. And it turns out that we were all correct.
That is so weird that his family would protect him so long and so hard. I mean, how much time and money were they spending protecting him after he killed those two poor girls?
I know. You know, one thing what we do have to acknowledge here is this horrible story is made even worse by the fact that we now know other members of the family were harboring him, even knowing what he did to Amina and Sarah. And that's disgusting. It's horrific. There are no words to describe how terrible a person you have to be to just accept that he did that and help him avoid punishment.
Yeah.
It's shocking. So Yasin and Islam Saeed, Sarah and Amina's uncle and brother, were also arrested separately in Euless, Texas, and they are now being charged with harboring a known fugitive. So for now, this is what we know. Yasin and Islam could be sentenced to up to 5 years in federal prison for their alleged crimes. That's for harboring a known fugitive. Yasir Saeed himself could face the death penalty. Law enforcement, including the FBI and the Irving Police Department, made statements at a press conference that they're still trying to reconstruct where Yasir Saeed was all of those years between 2008 and 2017.
Yeah, because
where was he? Who was helping him?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of impressive how long he stayed on the lam and avoided the FBI.
Especially, has he been in Texas this whole time? I mean, that would be shocking. I feel like he must have come back recently or something. I don't know. But FBI Dallas Special Agent Matthew DeSarno said that law enforcement will continue to look for those who provided aid and comfort to Yasir Saeed over the years to hopefully bring charges on those people as well. So they are not resting on their laurels. I mean, they're really trying to figure out who helped this man stay away from the law for so many years. And they're going to get punished too, so which I love.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Because yeah. That's what they deserve.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. So, you know, finally, everyone interested in true crime has these stories that speak to you, that stay with you. And Sarah and Amina's story clearly touched so many of you, myself included. This is just really joyous news. Now Sarah and Amina can rest in peace, and their family, friends, everyone who has been so moved by their story can all begin to heal. And that's the most important thing. So it's just, I'm so glad that that absolute monster hopefully will never see sunlight as a free man again.
Yeah.
That's what I hope. I hope and I'm pretty sure that's probably what's going to happen. He's never going to see the light of day as a free man again. And
I hope so. That's a good thing. And, you know, like you said at the beginning of this good news segment, that it was really wonderful to see how the response from everyone, not just from the episode, because it has been one of our most popular episodes and people were really touched by it. And it meant a lot to the family, the friends that were seeking justice for these girls, that there was resolution in this case. And thank you so much for writing into us after we got this news. We're all on the same page and the same cheering group over here. And it is definitely good news.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, obviously resolution will come in time. There's still probably a lot that's going to happen between now and once everything is done. Who knows if is everything going to be ever complete in this story, you know, especially if they're still searching for other people who helped Yasser Saeed this whole time. But, you know, I think for now we can just be really happy that this part is over.
Yeah.
Just the searching for the person who was responsible for the deaths of Amina and Sarah.
Yeah, and you know, it's not the only cold case that has seen some resolution in DFW.
That's right.
If you want to find out more about a really cold case about Carla Walker's case that broke, you can go over to our ACNC Posse discussion group over on Facebook. A lot of people have been talking about that case. So yeah, if you want to check out any of that information, there's a bunch of different articles and posts over there, and a lot of people in our group are talking about it. So it's a great place to talk about solving crimes.
Yeah, which is fantastic. I love that. I love solving crimes. Let's do more of that.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, so this is good news segment. I hope that you guys liked it. I'm over the moon. It's really great news and probably the best good news segment we've ever had.
Yeah. Go FBI.
That's right.
Well, all righty. We're into a segment we haven't done in a few episodes. We're going to give a recommendation here. I want to recommend a podcast that I've been listening to a little bit here lately. It's the Malice podcast. And Malice is a great show. It's run by our friend Ariel Cooksey. And this show is actually in the Texas Podcast Union. She's a new inductee into our union. And so she's local here in Texas. And her show is really interesting. She focuses on very violent offenders, some of the most violent offenders worldwide. And each episode, she talks about psychology, sociology, environments, and family dysfunction, and the neurobiology of some of these violent offenders. So very interesting perspective into some cases that you might have already listened to or heard the details of from a different show. She's going to give you kind of the science background of these offenders. And so her show's kind of like our show, where it's a little bit narrative and a little bit conversational. But the way she does it is she does a whole episode that's narrative, where she tells you kind of the synopsis of the case, the shorthand, just the basics of everything that happened, the details. But then in the second part, she will have a follow-up episode with one of her podcasting friends, and they will have a conversation about these cases. And it's really fascinating. So I just listened to her episode on Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, and she actually, in the follow-up episode, talked to a Toronto-based podcaster, so it was really interesting to get the Canadian perspective on that case. And yeah, I highly recommend it. You should check it out, and here is her trailer for her show right here.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ariel Cooksey, host of Malice. When violent acts occur, we tend to think the predators are monsters. Surely no human could do such things. But if we're honest, only humans commit malicious crime. And if you're like me, you want to know why. To find out, join me at Malice, wherever you listen to podcasts. Bye.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the after show. This is where we tell you all the places and wonderful things you can do to support the show or go find out more. So you can find us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. We also have our Facebook group that we talked about earlier, ACNC Posse Discussion Group. You can email us at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. We're also on Instagram, just All Crime No Cattle. And we have a website, allcrimenocattle.com. And if you'd like to donate to our Patreon and find more benefits and get some swag, you can go over to patreon.com and just search All Crime No Cattle. So next, we really have to pay some respect and, you know, give some shout outs to all of our wonderful Patreon supporters over there. So first and foremost, we need to say some thank yous to our Texas Rangers. Those include Lisa Layton, Serial Killer Sweets, Kate Williams, Don Maloney, Mickey V, Carol Lubahusen, Nigel, Emma Jordan, Jessica Dommel, Phoebe Southworth, Joanne Cooley, Becky Gildersleeve, Don N. Tanner, Haley Wilson, Noelle Richards, Leah Daugherty, Heather Brooke, Selena Camarillo Vasquez, and Jessica Layfield, our newest Texas Ranger. Next, we also need to give some shout-outs to our newest patrons, and in no particular order, that is Kimberly Weekly, Tyrone Hale, Renee Wilbanks, Sue Zarumsky, Randy Norton, Kim LaFoe, Krista Rogers, Catherine Milton, David Frias, Joanne Elton, Amanda Stansel, Amy Hamrick, Kelly Cohen, Michelle Ward, Tracy Boiso, Michelle Black, Linda Bond, and Matthew Craig. Thank you to all of our newest patrons. We really appreciate you. Without your support, there's no way we could even do the show, so it means a lot to us, and we have a lot of content that we are planning for you guys in the upcoming months to make 2020 just a little bit better, because 2020 has kind of sucked so far, Aaron.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah, and you know, we're turning over a new leaf for the last quarter of the year, and we're going to do our best to make this last quarter of the year worthwhile.
And the benefits start early, because next week, we will be releasing part two a little bit early just for you special patrons out there as a special thank you, and because we love you.
Yeah, and we're going to have some cool new items that you guys can get a hold of if you're a dog owner and a fan of the show. We'll talk a little bit about that in next episode. And there's just a lot of exciting things that we have planned. So thanks for supporting the show. If you haven't become a Patreon member yet, check it out. See, there's all kinds of tiers with different levels. But I also wanted to mention that Ken Williams reached out to us, and he let us know that his wife, Kimberly Williams, is not only a huge fan of the show and avid listener, but it's also her 28th birthday this week on Friday, and they're celebrating their 10-year wedding anniversary on Sunday, so it's a pretty special weekend for Kimberly, and on behalf of the show, I just wanted to say happy birthday and have a great weekend. They're also massive Stars fans, so that helps. I could tell by Ken's picture. He's in a Stars jersey. So thanks for writing in, Ken. Hope you guys have a great weekend. For now, that's all I have, Aaron. Do you have anything?
That's it. Haven't I spoken enough today?
You have. You've spoken quite a bit.
Thanks.
Well, until next time, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Goodbye.